WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When Otis Williams started rounding up singers for his vocal groups, he felt like Yul Brynner and the Magnificent Seven. He had several groups, including Otis Williams and the Siberians, Otis Williams and the Distance, and the Primes. But the group he'll always be remembered for, the group that he's been singing with for over 25 years, is the Temptations.
I've got sunshine.
My Girl was the first Temptations song that made it to number one on both the R&B and pop charts. The Temptations were one of the most successful groups on the Motown record label. They had great voices, great harmonies, cool clothes, and flashy dance moves. Otis Williams kept the group going long after the departure of their lead singers, David Ruffin and Eddie Kendricks. The Temptations have sung through the stylistic changes of the decades and even through the demise of Motown Records. Otis Williams has written an autobiography. It's titled Temptations. Welcome.
Thank you.
Fresh air.
Thank you.
You point out in your group the Temptations were subtler and more romantic than a lot of the other guys, and that there was no sweating or grunting on the stage. So I want to ask you how you think that was reflected in your songs and in your style on stage.
Well, I think that Paul Williams, who was one of the original members, he always believed in us trying to convey selling sex as well as keeping the class. And I wish I could take credit for not sweating, but him and I especially were sweaters. But we always tried to do things in a top-notch fashion. And
Well, you say in your book that you always thought about image. Even when you were in high school and you were singing in the halls and singing at dances, you thought about image.
Very important, you know, because when you're dealing with the public, it's always nice to set a very good impression. And we tried to do that with a very good image, a wholesome image and what have you. So that has always been one of our main criteria for trying to stay that kind of way, because it's so important.
Berry Gordy, the head of Motown Records, liked your singing, liked your style, and finally signed you to Motown Records. Did he tell you once he took you in what he had in mind for the group, changes he wanted to make?
Not necessarily. Barry was more or less into the record end of it. You know, people like Charlie Atkins, Lon Fontaine, Maurice King, and Johnny Allen, they would be the guys that would polish and mold and refine as far as the stage and the image and things of that nature. Barry was very concerned about the record end of it. Now, not to say that he didn't care how we went out, you know, and looked, because we were part of Motown and all under his auspices, but he was very into the creative end of it more so than anything else, and he left that up. That's why artist development came to be, because of he knew that he had to have somebody that I got all these talented artists here, the Supremes, the Four Tops, the Temptations, Martha and the Vandellas, the Miracles. Somebody needs to come in there and refine and polish them, so we wouldn't be just like everybody else and knew how to get on and off the stage while we were on stage.
Now, you said that Gordy really had more respect for producers and writers than he did for the performers. And I'd like to know what you meant by that, some examples of that.
Well, he had respect for the artists, but, you know, like I said, being a creative person, you know, he was very into, like, songs, because that's what he was really noted for, because he was a songwriter first, because he wrote songs for Jackie Wilson and Marv Johnson, Barrett Strong. And so I guess he was kind of partial to the producers and to the songwriters to make sure that whatever was being produced at Motown, it was done with the right kind of ingredient, with the right kind of song structure, which he always stressed, and make sure that the lyrics had meaning and where people could really identify and say, oh, yeah, I know what they're talking about. I've lived that. That's touched me before.
But in terms of the lack of power that the acts themselves sometimes had, you describe how if a group didn't show up in the studio on time for their recording date, he'd have another group come in and record the song.
Well, that's true. We had that happen to us with Do You Love Me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not because of us not coming to the studio and knew that we had to be there. It was that this one particular day we were at St. Stephen's Community Church and watching the Dixie Hummingbirds and the Harmonizing Four, because we were very into gospel groups. And so the next day when we came up to the company, and they said, man, where were you guys? Mr. Gordy, he was looking for you all over town because he had to see a song for you guys. We said, well, we were at church. At church? And so we said, well, we were into spirituals, and we just had to watch those guys sing. He said, well, he gave the song to the Contours, and it was Do You Love Me.
I can't imagine the Temptations singing Do You Love Me. It's, you know, I know the Contours version so well.
Right.
Doesn't seem like the perfect song for the group. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know now because he wanted to try it out on us, and I think it would have been designed for Paul Williams. We had the chance to do the song, but I think the record went to number two, and we were kind of jealous, but we were happy for the Contours as well because we felt that our time would come.
Otis Williams is my guest, the founder of the Temptations. Now, the first song that you had that really made it onto the charts, that crossed over onto the charts, was the way You Do the Things You Do. Now, this song was the result of a competition in-house, right?
Well, Barry always, like I stated in the book, he always had that competitiveness with his writers and his producers. You know, whoever would come up with the best product would get the release, and if they did it often enough, would get the most release, which would mean that you would make a lot of money. So Smokey had been writing, you know, and being very successful.
This is Smokey Robinson, who was your producer for
right,
a long time.
Right, and he had produced quite a few hits on Mary Wells. And when she left, that kind of opened up a little vacuum. So I guess he said, well, after writing My Guy, let me write My Girl. And so in 64, we recorded My Girl at the end of 64. And it was a big hit came February of 65.
Now, the way you do the things you do, Smokey Robinson also wrote that. Now, it's my understanding that there was a song competition of who would write. How did it work? Who would write the next song for the
Well,
Temptations?
Well, that was later on. That was when Smokey had written Get Ready, and Norman Whitfield had written and produced Ain't Too Proud to Be. So now we had a string of hits with Smokey, and Norman kept chipping away to the point that he really started coming up with very strong tracks, and he would have Eddie Holland of Holland Dozier Holland to write the lyrics for him. So he really had a strong package there. So every Friday, Motown was noted for the thing of having a quality control meeting where they would bring all the material that was recorded that week. Well, that Friday, they would have like an evaluation of who would get the release and what did they think would be this and that and the yeas and nays. So with Smokey having so much success with us, Barry was kind of torn between, yeah, I like that Ain't Too Proud to Beg, but Smokey did have the hit on Ain't Too Proud to Beg. I mean, My Girl and Get Ready. So he said, here's what I do. If Get Ready, I'm going to go with Get Ready, and if it should go to the top 10, Smokey will get the next release. Now, if Get Ready didn't go to the top 10 nationally, Norman, you have the next release, because it Ain't Too Proud to Beg was so strong that it could not be denied any longer. So Get Ready must have gotten to the top 20. Didn't crack the top 10. And so Norman came in there with Ain't Too Proud to Beg, and we had 7 years of hit-making with Norman Whitfield.
Okay, well, I want to play The Way You Do the Things You Do.
That's a good one.
Okay, and this was written by Smokey Robinson?
Yes, Smokey Robinson and Bobby Rogers.
The lead singer on this is Eddie Kendricks?
Eddie Kendricks.
And let's give it a listen, then we'll talk about the vocal harmonies.
Okay.
You know you could have been a candle. I'm holding you so tight. You know you could have been a handle. The way you swept me off the feet. You know you could have been a broom. The way you smell so sweet. You know you could have been some perfume.
The way you do the things you do,
the way you do
all day.
Otis Williams, which part were you singing on that record?
I was singing baritone. We would always sit around with Smokey, and Smokey was a very good producer in the respect of he would already have in mind how he wanted the harmonies to be structured, who would sing, what lead, and what have you. So it really was never no problem working with Smokey, because he would say, okay, we knew Melvin would sing bass. Eddie was on lead. Paul, he sang second tenor. David did first, and I was baritone.
Did you used to work out the harmonies before you joined Motown?
No, we all would pitch
in.
Together? Yeah. Because, you know, when you have five guys and everybody want their little voice to be heard about the creativeness, you would listen. And consequently, it would turn out to be very good, because like Richard, when we were the distance, he was good at sitting around the piano and picking out notes. So, you know, we all put our little 2 cents in.
You describe how some of the producers would have the singers sing slightly above their range.
Yes, yes. Motown was noted for recording their songs like a step higher, because they wanted the tension, the vocal dynamics, the stressing point, the pleading sound. So when you would hear it, you could say, oh, wow, I feel what he's saying, like pain in the voice. They didn't want you to sing too relaxed, because the song wouldn't come across with that emotional outlet, that meaning where you could really feel it. So they would always cut the tunes, especially Norman and Holland and Doja Holland would cut it a step higher, because that's the way Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded. It was recorded just a key too high for David, but he was able to do it. But it was not without us having to stop the tape and let him rest, because he was straining his vocal cords and his glasses were sliding all off his face and sweat was popping off. But we were, you know, just saying, go ahead, David, you can do it, you can do it. And it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers.
Now, did you have to be above your range also?
No, I didn't do that much leading in the songs that I did sing lead on. It was in the key, because I'm more or less a ballad person rather than the driving kind.
Okay. Otis Williams is my guest, and he's written an autobiography about his life forming and then singing with the Temptations. It's called Temptations. You described a little bit the competition between songwriters about who
right.
would get to write the next song for the group. Was there competition between the groups? Did you have to compete, say, with the Four Tops over who would get the song that you wanted to do?
No, because Barry never let that happen. He would always let, okay, Holland and Doja had the Supremes and the Four Tops, even though we really liked what they were doing, speaking of Holland and Doja Holland. But he said, no, you guys are having too much success with Smokey Robinson or Norman Whitfield. And then he didn't want all the songs to start sounding alike, you know, so he wanted to always make sure that there was that division, that separate kind of identity. And so he would never let that happen. Whereas Holland and Doja would just do, you know, more than what they should have done, and the sound would have become too saturated.
We got to talk about your choreography.
Okay.
The choreography for your group was done by Charlie Atkins, who was a great dancer and got his start like years before he started working with vocal groups.
Mm-hmm.
Dancing with Honey Coles. And
absolutely.
So describe some of the steps that he choreographed for the Temptations and the names for the steps, too.
Well, actually, Charlie, like you said, from the Charlie Atkins, Cole and Atkins vaudeville days, we had checked him out a long time ago when he used to do Frankie Lyman, and he really did a wonderful job on the Cadillacs, because he brought the house down with the Cadillacs at the Fox Theater. And Charlie's steps, let me tell you something, not easy.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I mean, he's got a lot of little hitch steps and, you know, a lot of little subtle movements. And you really have to pay a lot of attention, you know, because you look at the stuff that we do on stage and say, oh, that's easy. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, he's cussed us out and called us all kind of names, you know, because it would be hard to get, you know. But once you got a Charlie Atkins choreography down, you would definitely be separate and apart from any of the other acts, because his stuff is so unique that, you know, you just knew you had captured something very special, because he's not an easy fella to deal with as far as his choreography.
You said there were no extra beats for corrections when he was choreographing one of your songs. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, you had to learn it right then and there, because let's say if you got out of step, you would catch hell getting back in, because it's a lot of little hit steps, and he's got everything scientifically in place. So if you miss that and had to come back in. You said, oh, my God, how am I going to catch back in? Because, you know, a lot of times choreography is to a certain kind of beat. Charlie would hear something that you would have to really strain to hear on the record, and he would probably pick up something like if it was a guitar lick. Well, most cases, steps are choreographed to the drum or bass lick. But he would get something that's all together, that's faint, that you would say, man, I don't even hear that. But it would be there. So if you didn't really grab hold of that and lost that step, it would take a minute to get back in. So it was very tedious in learning Charlie's routines. But like I said again, once you learn it, people would stand up and applaud because it was something really unique.
Did you ever lose it on stage?
Oh, yeah. All of us at one time or another.
How would you cover up?
Oh, we'd cover up. But somewhere along the way, after a while, you say, oh, no, I got to get back in. So you would find a way to get back in. It was just something inside you said, you better find a way. So you would find a way, but it would be hard. You would miss a few bars before you got back in step. So we would cover it up. We'd clown a little bit. Oh, I'm right back to the bandstand to do it, and then come back up and, oh, okay, I got it. Boop, and fall right in. But you would catch L getting in for a while.
My guest is Otis Williams, and he's written an autobiography, and Otis Williams is the founder and leader of The Temptations. We'll hear more of their music and talk more about his life after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Otis Williams is my guest, and we're talking about founding and singing with The Temptations. And before we talk more about it, let's listen to another of The Temptations recordings. This is Since I Lost My Baby. You want to say anything about this before we
this
hear
it? Is one of my all-time favorites because the intro reminds me of a movie theme because it's so big, you know, and I really love the intro as well as the song.
And tell us what to listen to for your voice on here.
I am singing second tenor on this here. I'm singing right under Eddie. One of the things about the Temps, we are noted for being able to sing many different parts. Sometimes I sing baritone, second tenor, first tenor, aside from lead and lead. Never bass. That's exclusive to Melvin.
Okay, here we go. Since I Lost My Baby.
There's plenty of light.
Oh,
a new day is dawning, sunny and bright.
Oh,
but after I've been crying all night, the sun is cold and the new day seems old. Since I lost my baby.
Since I lost my baby.
Singing and the children are playing. There's plenty of work and the bosses are paying. Not a sad word should a young heart be saying. But
fun is a bore and with money I'm poor.
Since I lost my baby.
I said Temptations. My guest is Otis Williams, the founder and leader of the group. That's one of your many records that crossed over R&B charts and pop charts. Berry Gordy really wanted the group to cross over. He was really into crossing over.
Yes,
so were there things that he thought you should do to make sure you crossed over to the pop charts?
Well, he always stressed the thing of, like I said, lyrics, you know, had a large play in it and song structure. But he also stressed that the melody would be very simple, you know, whereas, you know, even a child could hum it. So he would stress as simple as you could keep it, the more mass appeal it would have.
Well, there's certain things you're supposed to do, like for the white listeners.
Keep it simple.
Keep it simple for the white people.
And for the black, but especially for, you know, that mass appeal. You know, just keep it like we said in the recording. I said it earlier today, and Joey and Suzanne, they died laughing, but when we are in the studio, sometimes you can get so sophisticated and carrying on with putting certain things together. So when we get to that point, we say, no, just K-I-S-S. And that means, in our term, keep it simple, stupid. Because most cases, when you look at the top 10, records basically are very simplistic, you know, and they have that mass appeal.
Well, I got the impression that the idea was that record buyers should be able to sing along with the song, so you
That's
didn't
it.
Want to do anything too complicated that we wouldn't be able to keep up with.
That was Berry's philosophy. That's it. You hit it dead on the head.
Let's talk about some of the problems with Motown and some of the problems within the group. When you signed your first contract with Motown, you were pretty young, in your teens or early 20s, I forget which.
Late teens, early 20s, yes. Mm-hmm.
Are there things that you shouldn't have signed that you did?
Well, at that time, you know, Motown being really the only game in town, so to speak, and we wanted to be there, you know. Barry had contracts that, let's say, now looking back on it, realizing the value of contracts and knowing the business like I do, those contracts weren't the best, you know. I mean, we were getting almost next to nothing in royalty rate and a 7-year contract, and they had everything. They took our name and all that stuff. So they weren't that great. They were geared for the protection of Motown, you know. So we signed it, and luckily, even though with those kind of contracts, we still made a large amount of money, you know. And so if they were like the contracts that we have today, my God, you know, it would have really even been better. But it was something that we had to grow to.
One of the problems internally in the group was when David Ruffin was doing a lot of the lead singing, you describe how he had a really big ego, and he wanted the group to be David Ruffin and the Temptations. He wanted his own limousine.
Yeah, well, he did have his own limousine, you know, because we at the time, we had two limousines. David had his, then that was a group limousine. Then we had a station wagon, so it would be like a caravan of three when we travel. But there was a time that we had to meet down in Puerto Rico. And we had a meeting because he felt as though by him doing the lead, he should have it David Ruffin in the Temptations. So we all said, no, that couldn't be, because Eddie was singing lead, Paul was singing lead, Melvin was doing Old Man River, and my lead wasn't that much, but we just felt as though it should just stay that one word, Temptation. And so, yeah, ego, you know, we all had egos, I guess, with him being in the lead spot, you know, and, you know, being as fantastic as he, you know, is and was at that time, you know, he just felt as though he should have had that kind of, you know, distinction. And we just said no.
Well, he left the group. Then Eddie Kendricks, the falsetto lead singer,
right,
left the group as well. Were there any conflicts ever between them over who should get more leads?
Not that I can recall, because like I said, by and large, during that time, Smokey was our producer, and Smokey would always have in his mind who he wanted to lead his song. So it never got to be that. And when we started working with Norman, Norman would most cases say, no, I want this and that guy. But then there were times we would say, hey, who would do it? But it never did get to be that kind of a conflict.
Let me play another Temptation song in which Eddie Kendricks and David Ruffin share the lead. This is You're My Everything.
You're My Everything.
Say something about it before.
That was one of the tunes that I sang first tenor on. And Eddie said, oh, man, you can go and do it, because I was more comfortable singing second tenor and baritone. But Eddie was getting ready to sing lead. And we were saying, well, okay, now, hey, Eddie, if you sing a lead, who's going to do the first tenor part? You. Me. I said, man, I can't sing that. He said, man, I hear you hitting those high notes in canon. You can do it, Otis. And we got down there, and I did do it. And I think, no, it was another tune, but I started to say Paul missed the part on that. But he was there. It was Born to Love You that Paul wasn't on. But I ended up singing first tenor. I think Paul was singing second tenor, and David was up over me, and Melvin on bass.
Let's give it a listen. You're My Everything.
Yeah. my dream is about you. Honey, I couldn't live without you.
Temptations singing You're My Everything. Otis Williams, the founder of the group, is my guest. You have kept the group together after the leaving of the lead singers through the decades, through the psychedelic period, through funk. Have you ever had another thought cross your mind of doing something besides singing with the Temptations?
Well, there's other things I want to do, you know, but first and foremost, I like doing what I'm doing, being a member of the Temps and the challenges that we have been faced with and being able to, ride them out, what have you. So I like what I do.
And just tell me, we only have a few seconds left. How is it different for you performing on stage now as a mature man as opposed to as a teenager and a young man when you started?
Well, it's not that much difference because you're still entertaining people, except they have grown with us. And, you know, you see a lot of the new generation because when we were coming along in the 60s and those that were following us now, they have kids, so they're bringing their kids to come see us. So it's that kind of difference. But we still get the adrenaline flow from seeing so many happy faces, and sometimes they are crying tears of joy. So it's still that electrifying feeling of performing to people of the world over. So it's still great 28 years later.
Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Otis Williams, the founder of the Temptations, and they're still singing today. And he's written an autobiography. It's called Temptations. It's published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.